Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast. It is Friday the 13th. Holy moly.
Spooky.
It's spooky only because I walked by a dollar store today and they're already putting up Halloween decorations.
Yikes.
It's that time. Back from the IFAs, Andrew Martinick and Hayato Huseman. Welcome back. Are you recovered?
I mean, I just got back like less than 24 hours ago, so no, I'm not.
You're not. Where did you go?
I went to Amsterdam, and I ended up staying longer than I expected after a canceled flight. So I was expecting to be back a while ago. I finally made it.
So what was Amsterdam like this time of year?
It was actually cold and slightly rainy, which was kind of weird, but still massively overrun with tourists, which is unfortunate. I was expecting to miss out on some of the tourists because the weather had started to turn, but it was still a lovely time. I really liked that city a lot.
What'd you do? Just walk around?
Walk around, had a lot of good food and drinks, took a lot of photos, and then covered the Apple event in the evening on Central European time, which was interesting. So that was a little different.
So 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. What was that? 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds like a fun way to spend an evening. and that is something that we will talk about a little bit later. But first, because you guys didn't get your butts together in Germany, in Berlin, you were too busy eating currywurst to get your... you know, to get a podcast together. We're going to finish up last week's episode, I guess, with some of the other announcements that came out of IFA. Both of you were there. So we want to talk about four phones that were announced during the show. I feel like this is more phones than were at IFA 2018, but maybe I'm wrong.
I'm not sure. I would have to actually look back, but I was also surprised by the number of mobile announcements. It was actually a stealthily like packed show. No one phone jumped out at me, but there was like a lot of stuff and across a lot of different market segments.
Yeah, I mean, we were pretty much busy from the very first day to the very last, like just nonstop working. So I mean, I guess for better or worse, it's like that's a good sign as far as amount of devices there.
And Hayato, what was your favorite announcement from the show?
You know, probably it's kind of weird to say. I'm kind of excited to see what happens with the LG G8X. I think we kind of all sat in on that briefing and kind of all expected to, you know, like, oh, well, it's another LG G8. It's going to be pretty much the same thing with two screens. But the more we sat through the briefing, I think we all kind of like gradually, you know, started thinking like, oh, actually this looks pretty sick. It's like there's the dual screen looks like it's surprisingly useful in some ways that I wasn't expecting. So I'm excited to see what happens with that.
Yeah, but okay, I'm not really sure I understand this, because this is the second foldy screen accessory that LG's announced this year. But they didn't actually release it for the V50.
Right.
It was just kind of this thing that they brought to MWC. But we never saw it in action other than like in a very small press briefing. Now they're saying they're ready to release this and even might release it in the box with the G8X.
I'm really happy to hear that Hayato thought this was the most interesting thing, because it actually ended up being mine as well. And I think it's just unfortunately tempered by this fact that you're pointing out that they did it with the V50, but only in South Korea, and then they just never talked about it again. I think that part of that is because they realized that they did it wrong the first time, and they've made a lot of changes with the G8X's version that are considerably better. It basically comes down to the secondary screen is now a hardware connection. It's over USB-C rather than like a high bandwidth wireless connection, which is really important for responsiveness and touch. It also is the same panel as the main screen, which baffled me about the V50s. It was a different panel, and so it looked different right next to the main screen, which was just dumb. And also it gave them more time to look at the software and really clean it up, and kind of in a very anti-LG way, they're not doing anything special it's or trying to do anything over the top. They're literally just using
and they're not trying to do anything. Andrew.
They're not trying to
That's
do anything.
Problem.
Well, it's just Android's built-in extra or screen was it extended display system, and so it just extends the screen, and then they just added a couple software features to take advantage of it, and they actually really thought it through well in the things that they did. They did change. I think that it's a really interesting idea that needs another like three or four iterations or generations, whatever you want to call it, however long that takes to make sense in like a packaging perspective, because it's kind of big and thick and all that kind of stuff. But you know, what I wrote in my G8X hands-on was this actually is a more practical, pragmatic take on a foldable right now, considering how massive the trade-offs are for all these other foldables that we're seeing.
Okay. I disagree with you completely.
Go
but
on.
That's cool. I think it's lazy. I just think LG didn't want to develop a foldable phone, or they haven't been able to put together a usable form factor. They may not have the same, they may not be as far along as Samsung and Huawei.
Quite possible.
With the same screen tech. We knew back with the V30 and the Pixel 2 XL just how far behind their OLED tech was. They seem to have caught up somewhat, but clearly the foldable aspect of those OLED displays is a little bit more difficult, as we know. Now, I'm not praising Samsung or Huawei here. Those phones haven't been released yet. We don't know how well they hold up.
Really figured it out either.
But at least they're way further along. And as I think practical as this is, there's no... Actually, I don't think it's practical. I think it's antithetical to what we want in a smartphone today. And I think it's utilitarian. I think that's the adjective. It's interesting that they've put together something that feels complete out of a hack, essentially.
Yeah, I think utilitarian is a good word for it, though. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing, because all these other foldable phones, you know, they're cutting edge and sexy or whatever other words you want to use, but nobody wants to touch a plastic screen on their $2,000 phone. Nobody wants to have to worry about the fragile, you know, the fragile kind of form factor. I like that the G8X, even though like the dual screen thing seems kind of hacky, it's like you can just take it out when you're not using it and you just have a normal phone that feels right to use.
Right. So let me pose a scenario here, because I lived with the Moto Z series for so long. What do you do with the second screen when you don't want to use it? Where do you put it?
That's kind of the one problem with that. The only solution they really have right now is relatively seamless. It has a 180 degree hinge, so it does fold all the way to the back, and it attaches with magnets and turns off the screen, the second screen. So when you fold it back, it does, you know, it doesn't like flop around like a wallet case or something. It actually folds back like solidly, like a laptop does. Mm-hmm. And so you at least have that. It's obviously thick and heavy at the same time, but like, you know how awkward the Galaxy Fold is to use when it's closed. It's actually more awkward than this because it's so much thicker and kind of funky to reach around. But so there is that problem. I think LG dropped they kind of used the V50 in South Korea as a weird like test bed, as they typically do with South Korea. And they talked about how I think it was 60% of people using the V50 with the second screen kept it on all the time, like kept it physically attached all the time and just dealt with folding it over the back. So they at least got a decent amount of attachment there. But then they also pointed out that 30% of people kept it at home 100% of the time. And so it was just like a home thing. And they come home, they put it on there, and then because, you know, they're not sticking it in their pocket or whatever, and they're just, you know, keeping it around the house. So it's tough to see that everyone would be using this.
So it's like a living room foldable. It's like a dock for your phone that happens to give it a second screen when you want it.
I guess so.
I'm not against the idea. I feel like it is not practical in any other situation than you should leave it on the entire time. That's it. Well, like, if unless you decide to keep it on your phone 24/7, you're never gonna use it. And if you do keep it on your phone, you have two additional problems, right? A, yes, you have a thicker phone, but you also have a second screen powered by the USB port. It doesn't have additional battery, so you're actually lessening your battery life with the second screen, not adding to it.
Not having a spare battery is definitely an issue.
Well, I think the biggest problem is, like I said, this is going to be better if they keep going with this in a few generations, because they still have a weight problem. The second screen weighs like 2/3 the weight of a G8X. So it adds another 2/3 or so of the weight. And so if they were to put a battery in this thing, it would be absolutely unwieldy. It would be way too heavy. So they're already making weird decisions, like putting glass on the outside of the second display that's heavier, and putting this little secondary ticker display on the outside. Like, you don't need to do all this stuff. If they would have focused on trying to make it as thin and light as possible, that probably would have been better. And so there's definitely an ergonomic issue there, but it would have just been made even worse by putting more battery in there.
So have they talked at all about bringing this to the US? Because we know the G8 and the V50 had very limited, well, the G8 didn't, but the V50 has had very limited availability, given that it's a 5G only phone. But is this something that North Americans are going to be able to pick up when it comes out?
So this is where we get back to the LG gonna LG part of this, is they're trying to convince every carrier around the world to include this second screen in the box, or, you know, include it as part of the purchase price as a bundle, but they're not forcing the carriers to do that. And so it's ultimately up to the carrier to choose, even though LG fully realizes that if they're offered separately, that nobody's going to buy the second screen. Like, it has to be something that has to come with it, and then they figure it out along the way. They're never going to decide to pick it up for whatever, $200 later, which would be like an incredible ask. I expect the US carriers to maybe offer the G8X at some point, but man, they're probably going to screw it up and not include the second screen. And that's going to be really annoying. And I just don't understand how LG can't just put its foot down, especially considering it offers the G8. If a carrier wants to keep selling the G8, go for it. But if you want the G8X, they should just force them to have the second screen and let it stand on its own merits, because it is something that's at least different, even if you don't think that it's, you know, the foldable killer.
Also, one thing that's weird to me is they lowered the screen resolution to 1080p.
They did, yeah.
Yes.
From even though it's a larger 6.4-inch display, did they mention why that was the case?
You have to imagine part of that is just to
this battery
make up
life?
For, yeah, like to make up for the added drain and battery of using the dual screen.
I also think that because they went with the same panel on both, I think that they had GPU concerns over running two quad HD displays at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, that is fair. That is a fair, very fair point. Okay, so we'll learn more about it. I mean, other than that, you know, other than the wacky second screen, this is just a larger G8, and it has a similar but not identical camera setup. 12 megapixel main sensor, 13 megapixel ultra wide, but it's a little bit different. The actual sensors are a little bit different. It's much more like the V40, V50. 32 megapixel front camera, which is interesting, and some cool effects coming out of that, but still emphasis on media consumption. Lots of, you know, I like the fact that like the second screen can be tweaked in so many ways. I remember ZTE tried this with the Axon M, and it was like the idea was so sound, but it implemented so badly because there were so few things you could do with that second screen that made sense. So at least LG sort of thought through the implications of adding a second screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, extend the browser across both screens. You can use the one of the screens as a game controller, albeit a virtual game controller. So lots of cool things. I mean, check it out. See our video, Andrew's hands-on, and let us know what you think, podcast at Android Central. So we're going to move on to talk quickly about three more devices, the Moto One Zoom, the Nokia 7.2, and the Sony Xperia 5, all of which were announced during the show, and you know, all of which are certainly not flagships, but interesting in their own right. I'll talk, Hayato, you got your hands on the Xperia 5. You've been using the Xperia 1 for quite a while. What's interesting about this phone? Is it five times better than the Xperia 1? Or like what does that naming scheme even mean?
It's hard to say what like about the naming scheme. I think kind of their thinking was it's a little better than the Xperia 10, which is like their budget phone. But it's not quite as good as, or at least it's not quite as big as the Xperia 1, which is, I guess, their main flagship. It's very similar to the Xperia 1. It's got the same specs. It's got pretty much everything's the same aside from like the screen size and the battery. So it's just a slightly smaller version of the 1. It feels, I think, way better just because the 21:9 display, like the size difference between the two phones isn't huge, but it's enough that like that aspect ratio just works better for the slightly smaller form factor, I think. But it's pretty much just an Xperia 1, but slightly smaller. Still has like the HDR plus OLED display, which looks really, really good, even though now it's only 1080 versus 4K. Not a big deal to me because, I mean, come on, like 1080p is more than enough on a phone these days. It's like the exact same phone I've been using for months now. But it comes in really cool colors. I like that red a lot, and I like the blue. Other than that, it really is just pretty much identical.
So what pains me about this is that it's not a compact. Like they're sort of positioning it as the compact version of the Xperia 1, but there is nothing about this phone that is compact. The price isn't compact. The device isn't compact. I want my Xperia Z, 3 compact life back. Right? I just that was such a perfect size for a flagship phone. And I think Sony understands that very few people actually want that size screen anymore. Like the 5, like what is it? The last one was a 5-inch or 5.2-inch.
Yeah.
It sounds big, but it's like compared to today's phones, it's not.
I mean, with the 21:9 aspect ratio, you can get away with a much larger sounding display just because obviously they're measured diagonally. So it just, It does feel pretty small. It's definitely not like the, XZ, whichever was the last one, XZ4 compact.
I think XZ2 was the last one.
Really? Only two?
I don't think they made an XZ3 compact, but yeah, they didn't. They made an XZ1 compact and an XZ2 compact.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not as small as those, but it's better than the Xperia 1. I think it's almost like the size of the Pixel 3, but just a little bit taller, obviously, with the longer display.
Because the XZ, geez, I'm messing up. The Xperia 1 is just too damn tall.
Oh, it's enormous, like,
It's so awkward that I know that this isn't a compact, in the typical Sony sense, but it's makes a whole lot more sense just shaving it down. I mean, you put them side by side, the 5 and the 1, and it's not that big of a difference when you look at it, but when you hold it, it's a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, anybody at home, if you've got a Samsung smart TV from the last few years, this the Xperia 1, as far as height goes, is almost identical to that Samsung remote. The Xperia 5 is definitely smaller than that.
This is a very random comparison to make.
It's all I've just got because, like, that's the TV I have, so I don't know. But it's legitimately the length of a remote, so it's a little much. Xperia 5 is not quite that bad.
I mean, to be fair, a lot more people have that Samsung TV than have a Sony phone, so that's actually a pretty apt comparison.
Wow,
you don't even think about it, but you're like, oh yeah, I do have that Samsung remote. Or like my dad has that Samsung remote.
Gets lost in the couch all the time, and so does this phone.
The best thing I did was just like, I don't like my LG OLED TV remote, but I basically never have to use it now because I just use my NVIDIA Shield controller and the remote, and it turns on the TV for me. And then when I'm done, it just turns off after like 20 minutes.
Arguably,
never have to touch a TV remote again.
Arguably, more people have an NVIDIA Shield than Xperia 1 as well.
I mean,
dang.
Can we just keep going? Like, more people have syphilis than the Xperia. I guess a lot of people have syphilis.
Goodness. I didn't think you were going to go there, but all right.
Let's move on. Let's talk about the Sony or the Nokia 7.2 and 6.2. So this was, you did this briefing in New York before the show. I'm kind of digging the green color. I mean, green seems to be the color of fall 2019 for phones, just given that.
I love it.
But this is like a forest green. I think it's beautiful. And Nokia just makes nice mid-range phones. I really dig this design.
I do too. It was really nice, like really fun to film because that green kind of shifts depending on how you look at it between like this very like matte satin kind of look and you know, like certain angles it'll turn into a glossy kind of finish. But no matter what angle you look at it, it's like a perfect green. I really like the green of the new iPhone, but this is so much better, I think. And, you know, the 7.2 is a much more affordable phone, of course. It's very nice. It's built really well. It's obviously got Android One software. I like it a lot.
So €299, did they give any indication that it will be coming to the US as an unlocked phone?
If I remember, it's been... You know, I know it's only been 2 weeks, but it just feels like such a blur at this point with IFA and everything. I think they said, yes, it will be coming to the States for somewhere around $350 or $400, I believe.
Right. And that's the price of the Nokia 7.1, which is one of our favorite mid-range phones. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good idea. And, you know, it's running Android One. It's got all that kind of... All the specs you'd expect from a mid-range device, better camera than the 7.1, but still mid-range Snapdragon processor, 4 to 6 gigs of RAM. You know, not a huge upgrade, but definitely a big deal.
Can't you be a little disappointed that it's running a Snapdragon 660?
Yeah. I mean, you can.
If it's going to be, I mean, $350-ish. Dollars and you're looking at a really old mid-range 6 series processor.
That's
just
fair.
a little funky. I mean, the outside of the phone and the design and everything like looks great, and I'm sure the, you know, that's going to push some sales, but, and you know, the rest of the specs are fine, but it's just a weird skimp, and it just kind of points to Nokia going with this really iterative, you know, release cadence that they do, that it's individually you look at them and you're like, oh wait, that's not that great compared to some of the competition at $350 to $400.
I think a lot of it is you're paying for the design and the build quality, because, you know, yeah. You compare this to like a Pixel 3a, the Nokia is built much better and the hardware I think looks much nicer, but of course the Pixel is going to have a slightly better processor, and it's, while I haven't really spent much time with the cameras of the Nokia 7.2, I'm sure the Pixel is going to still take better photos. Even though the Nokia does have the advantage of more cameras, you do have that wide angle lens, which is really nice, but I'm sure the overall output's going to be better from the Pixel still.
Yeah, I just think about something like the Galaxy A50, which is by all accounts just a really, really good phone for $350 and just has higher end specs, same kind of triple camera. But you're obviously then just deciding between, you know, Samsung design and software or Nokia design and Android One software. But it's not like, I mean, for a long time, Nokia phones, you know, for a couple of years there were like, yeah, those are just the defaults. It's like at each price point, you're either picking a Nokia or a Motorola. And now in that $300 to $400 range, there are actually other options that, you know, makes you start to be a little more critical of what Nokia is doing.
Yeah, I actually think it was a pretty shrewd move by Samsung bringing the A series to the US, selling it at carriers, and now unlocked. You can get the A50 next week, September 20th, for $350, which is pretty reasonable for a phone that Harish said when he reviewed it earlier this year was the best mid-range phone you could buy, like in that price range. That was before the Pixel 3a was out, but still a really, really good deal.
Mm-hmm.
All right, quickly, the Moto Zoom. This is weird. So I haven't seen it, but I'm going to take your word for it that it's a nice looking phone that Nokia was like. So apparently, Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, was told during his briefing that they had no intention of bringing it to North America until enough press was like, yeah, this is a great phone. You should bring this to the US.
What are you doing?
So they now sell it at Motorola.com, but only for T-Mobile and AT&T. So it's a GSM-only device, unlike most Motorola phones. But yeah, I mean, four cameras on the back, interesting design overall, and $450. What do you guys think?
Light up Motorola logo on the back. Light up Motorola logo on the back. Come on.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually the best feature.
I mean, other than that, once you get over how cool that is, like this is one of the things that I'm talking about with the competition for Nokia 7 series. It's like, this is a really nice looking phone too. It has all the same kind of specs, maybe bumped up a little bit. They're all starting to standardize on this multi-camera look and bigger displays and like 4,000-ish milliamp hour batteries. This is a really nice looking phone. I'm also baffled why they didn't think to bring it to the US. I understand that they maybe didn't want to do a separate SKU and get the CDMA stuff in there, but even if they just did it like they're doing it now from the start, I'd be okay with that. Sell it unlocked.
Yeah, I'm actually waiting for my review unit to come in for this. The cool thing about it is, you know, while Motorola doesn't have a great legacy of camera quality, it's got a really great camera experience. So if this, you know, it has a 48 megapixel main sensor, it's got a 3x telephoto, it's got a pretty nice ultra wide, and it has a dedicated depth sensor. So hopefully all of those things will add up to a decent camera experience. And if nothing else, you got the light up Motorola logo, obviously the best part of the phone. So yeah, we'll be reviewing this, but I'm pretty psyched for it.
Definitely a little bit of a question of how much you really care about, you know, Motorola. Once you get over like the $400 point, we know that they make great phones in the $200 to $300, but some of their quality, like you said, in the camera quality, you know, just raw photo quality, kind of starts to get in the way once you get over $400. But I still think it's going to be an interesting option.
I mean, I think it's nice that they chose to do a 3x optical zoom instead of a 2x, like pretty much everybody else does. This feels very much like a budget version of like any of the recent Huawei flagships that have, you know, like the hybrid zoom. I think this says 10x. And like, the 3x optical zoom is great because 2x I just don't think is enough on most phones.
Well, it doesn't make sense. I was baffled why Apple, of all companies, did not extend the focal length to 3x equivalent. It just, you get so little out of a 2x, especially with the quality of the sensors. You can just crop in. You really don't lose that much detail.
Right.
Just go all the way. Give it 3x, give it 5x like Huawei did. And
yep.
Just, yeah. What are you going to lose? Especially if you have an ultra wide, like it just gives the camera so much more versatility.
I'm just so happy to start to see a lot of these mid-range phones having a triple camera too. It doesn't have to be reserved to the high end.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that was kind of there were a ton of other things announced at IFA, including the new Kirin 990 chip that's going to be inside the Huawei Mate 30 and Mate 30 Pro. We know that phone or those phones are going to be announced on September 19th, so next week as of recording. That'll be interesting. I'm excited about it, except for the fact that rumors have it that they're not allowed to put Google apps on it yet because they don't have Google doesn't have an exception by the US government to provide those services to Huawei yet. So what we're looking at is a phone potentially launching without any Google services included.
This is going to be a disaster.
Yeah, it's going to be bad. So my guess is that they're going to announce it. The phones that reviewers will get will be sort of early hardware, and they're going to finagle a way to get Google Apps onto it, which may not be totally legal, but whatevs. We're just not going to talk about it. And then they're going to delay the phone until they get the requisition. And that may be months. So who knows? We may not actually get the May 30 until much later this year.
Wow. Yeah, I want to see how they message that. I want to see how they handle it. I'm sure that they have all kinds of different contingency plans for various different scenarios. And I'm sure that they have phones that are done and sitting in boxes with each of the different software types. But if they can't do it officially out of the box, it's just DOA. You're not going to be able to get it out to the general marketplace and say, you know, put a little insert in the box that says, okay, all you have to do is, like, you don't expect people to have to sideload Google Apps. I mean, I understand that that's what they would have to do, but that is just a terrible out-of-box experience, and everybody is going to hate it.
I feel like they should just go one step further and include a one-tap root feature on the phone. So you load it up, and you just press tap to root. It roots your phone, gives you an unlocked bootloader, and then says, okay, now here's a link to XDA developers. Go and find your own personal ROM and install it yourself. Have fun.
I mean, TBH, can every phone have that?
They did have that for a long time.
I was thinking more of like, you have a card with a QR code on it or something, and you scan it and it takes you to some page to download it, or you give them a small USB-C flash drive in the box or something. Just something
safe.
Extremely shady.
Put this USB-C thumb drive into your computer and see what happens.
Insta-hack.
It'll be totally fine. Just trust us. Okay, let's talk Pixel 4, because holy cow, we have so much Pixel 4 stuff to talk
about.
We'll
have Google Apps out of the box.
Yeah, we already have Google Apps out of the box, because this thing has been, I guess, stolen. We're not really sure how all of these Vietnamese bloggers and YouTubers got Pixel 4s, but the rumor has that, Google moved a lot of its manufacturing to Vietnam this year. We know that for the Pixel 3a, we weren't sure about the Pixel 4, but I guess they did, because the past couple of days have seen not just like sketchy potato leaks, but actually properly produced YouTube videos reviewing the Pixel 4. So that's been fun. Let's go over a few of the things that we've learned. We know that it'll have a 90 hertz display, which is kind of great.
Here for that.
We know that it'll have a brand new camera app, which is pretty nice. We've seen the face unlock work now because the UI is all set up. The only thing we haven't seen, in fact, is Project Soli and the motion sense stuff, because it'll only turn on in countries where it's been approved to work, and it probably just isn't approved to work in Vietnam yet. So what's your take on this? Andrew, is it all over for the Pixel 4 now? Does nobody care?
Well, we had the exact same discussions around the Pixel 3, because that thing was, seen and unboxed and reviewed and camera samples taken weeks before the announcement too. And what ended up being most interesting in the Pixel 3 was all of the issues that cropped up in the month and 2 months after it launched, where we found out that, there was software instability and there were, performance problems. And we subsequently also got updates, and the camera got better and night sight was amazing. So knowing all of these things doesn't spoil my excitement for actually being able to use the Pixel 4 and see how these things actually come together. I mean, sure, we know that the secure face unlock works, but well, of course, it's going to, technically work. The question is how it works in the real world. And the same thing is going to be for the Soli gestures. Same thing is going to be for this new camera setup. Sure, we know the technical parts of it, and we've seen the camera interface. But, for me, the most important part is, can I be listening to music and open the camera and take a photo in less than 20 seconds? without the thing crashing. And
without with your photo actually saving this time.
Right, and with the music staying playing. So yes, we know the technical stuff, but some of the biggest problems have been the polish and execution with Google's phones, not necessarily the features. They've had lots of really good ideas, but the way that they come together and work in the real world over time has been the issue. And those are things that you just don't know until you actually have it in your hands.
So I think one of the most important things that we've discovered is that the Panda Pixel is coming back, because yes, that thing was that color scheme, the black and white Pixel 2 and 2XL, or no, it was just the 2XL, was my favorite part of that otherwise pretty terrible phone. So what else about this is getting you excited, Hayato?
I'm just hoping it's got better battery life. The Pixel 3 is if I'm packing for a trip, that's the first phone that I just leave on my desk, because I know it's like as great of a phone as it is. It like doesn't even make it through my whole flight half the time. So, until the Pixel until it can make it through a day, like it's just not a good option for me. But I am kind of looking forward to checking out Project Soli, and I'm really excited to have an actual focus on real depth mapped face unlock on an Android phone, because I think, at this point, a couple of Android makers have done it. LG did it with the G8, I believe. And I think Huawei's done it once or twice, but it would be great to have, actual support from Google, or a real focus from Google on that Face ID style face unlock, rather than like these in-display fingerprint sensors that I just cannot get into. I would love for face recognition to get better on Android.
Well, it can't get much worse. Let's put it like that.
Yeah.
I caught a lot of flack for putting out this tweet, but I said basically my favorite part of the Pixel 4 is that they're copying Apple with a face unlock, because my experience with Face ID has been wholly positive. It works in good light, it works in bad light, it works when I'm wearing sunglasses, it works at pretty odd angles, although when it's lying flat on the table, obviously it doesn't work, and apparently that's improved with the iPhone 11 series. But the Huawei Mate 20 Pro, which has a similar feature, did not work for me. It didn't work in good light, it didn't work in bad light, it was completely inconsistent, and I turned it off. Same thing with the G8, it did not work for me. It was a completely overrated feature. And I wanted these things to work. I do not want to have to use a fingerprint sensor. Neither of those phones. And they use different solutions, right? LG's solution was completely different to Huawei's. Huawei was much more similar to the Face ID feature, whereas LG uses a time of flight module. So technically, there was no reason why both of them shouldn't work properly. They just didn't. I really want Google to implement this well and make it consistent, and also do it better than Apple, so that you can put your phone on the table and it'll just work, because Google knows a lot about you, and they should use more than just the time of the illumination and dot projector. They should use a bunch of different things to determine that your phone is yours and that it should unlock when you look at it.
I want it to work well, but it, mostly because I've been using the Note 10 lately, and the in-display fingerprint is just not good. On my travels here, I don't know what the deal was, but it just decided it didn't like my left thumb anymore, and it just stopped working for a while. And I was traveling. I didn't want to unenroll my fingerprints, and now it just started working again. I don't know. But I'm frustrated with that, and so I want to try something else like Face Unlock. But also, I remember that the OnePlus 7 Pro's in-display fingerprint sensor is great, and I would kind of just be happy with that instead.
Right. I mean, it is good. I'll give it that. It works. If I don't care. I don't think about it. I don't want to have to think about unlocking my phone. I just want it to work.
And for me, the other big, well, I understand that, but the big thing for me is that you're getting this big display loss, this wide notch or whatever you want to call it, this big bezel at the top. you know, in the iPhone's case or the Pixel 4's case, they're going to need both Face Unlock to be really good and solely to have some kind of value to my use of the phone on a regular basis, if not on a daily basis, to justify having that big old bezel up there. Because as much as I'm annoyed by the in-display fingerprint sensor in the Note 10, I love the screen and the tiny bezels.
Can I just say that, like, as much as I also love the design of the Note 10, like, I'm so okay with having a bit of a forehead on my phone. And like, as much as I really dislike the Pixel 4's rear design, I think the front of it looks totally fine. I'm all on board with having like that sliver of bezel up top, like as opposed to a notch or a hole punch or whatever. It's really refreshing to see somebody still doing that. And I'm very ready for that on the Pixel 4.
I agree with you. I mean, it is what it is. Google is not going for smallest bezel awards, right? It's not something that's ever mattered. I saw somebody using a Pixel 2 the other day, and it kind of looked cool in a retro way. I was like, oh yeah, I loved my Pixel 2 with that massive chin and forehead because the speakers were amazing. And really, the phone was just sized perfectly. The Pixel 3 obviously is, I think, the best compromise of all.
Agreed.
Because you get the front-facing speakers, you get a decent-sized screen, and you still get a bit of bezel. But that phone has been basically ruined for me because of what Hayato said. Like, the battery life is so atrocious that I don't even want to use the phone anymore. So I'm actually, like, I've chosen to use the Pixel 3a over the Pixel 3 since the 3a came out because the battery life is so much better. It's like night and day better.
I've heard that from a lot of people. I would love to try the battery on the Pixel 3a, but hopefully that just translates to the same kind of battery life on the Pixel 4, or maybe even better if that's not asking too much.
I'm just gonna, I think I wrote this, a few weeks back now, that I'm just not gonna hold back on completely roasting the Pixel 4's battery if it's bad, because there are other phones, just about every other phone, let's be honest, that has better battery life than the Pixel 3, and frankly, even the 3 XL. And so if they don't catch up considerably, it's just not worth giving them a pass anymore. Google has not proven that its high-end phones can have even acceptable battery life, and that's obviously unacceptable.
How bad do you think that 90 hertz display is going to impact battery?
It's going to nuke it.
I don't think it will. I think it's a variable refresh rate like the OnePlus 7 Pro. So,
but things are always moving on your, you know, you're just saying that when things aren't moving on the display, then
yeah,
it'll drop.
Yeah, but it'll drop to 60 hertz. And I think, you know, Google, for all of its optimization issues, I don't see this being a problem, right? Like, Google developed Android, like they've got access to the low-level display drivers. They know what they're doing here. If it's going to have bad battery life, it's because it's just the Pixel line is cursed or something. Like, I don't know how else to put it. I have had zero issues with the 3A. I think that Google has it in them to make phones with decent battery. My only concern is that the rumored capacity of the 4 is only 2,800 milliamp hours, which
My
is
God.
Smaller than the Pixel 3. So
smaller than the Galaxy S10e.
What's up with that? That makes no sense.
Well, Google and battery life, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I have nothing else to say about it. Okay, so we know that it's going to have 6 gigs of RAM, which is a nice bump from 4 gigs. Hopefully it'll prevent all of those problems that you had mentioned. You know, the whole not saving your camera thing. 128 gigs of storage possible, but then we've also heard that 64 gigs is going to be the standard.
Ugh, and that coming, would be weird.
Coming off of the backlash from Apple releasing its new phones with 64 gigs standard, I don't think Google should go this route. I'm really, really upset by this. I think 64, even with all of these cloud storage solutions, is just not big enough.
It's not.
Yeah, 128 should just be the standard. You can argue, like, Apple's never really played the massive, you know, spec storage number, but 64 gigs on an iPhone 11 Pro, quote-unquote Pro, is lame. and it's just as bad on a Pixel 4. I think that it's not that hard. Just like, I don't understand why you don't just put 8 gigs of RAM in the thing instead of 6. 128 should just be fine. Like, I don't think that many people need more than 128. That's why it should just be the standard, so that you don't have to think about it. I wouldn't be upset with offering 128 and that's it. You don't need to offer a 256 or a 512 or anything like that. People can kind of massage and work around a 128, but when you put out 64 as the base, now you have to have another SKU and you have to have another storage option. So you think that they could maybe streamline it a bit with one SKU.
So what else have we seen? We saw, the overall Android 10 UI looks basically the same. The new camera app looks kind of neat. We had seen NightSight moved onto the main tab bar in the camera app in a couple of weeks ago, which I think is much better than hiding it in the overflow menu.
Absolutely.
I use it more than I use portrait mode, so I'd actually prefer to be able to move that next to the camera mode specifically. Mm-hmm. However, it looks like Google is finally providing a bit more granularity inside the camera app, which I appreciate, because even though they're not offering a pro mode or a manual mode, there's a lot more tweaking you can do now that there's a dual camera in there.
Yeah, Google's camera interface was always simple, and that was great, but they never gave anybody an option to tweak if they really wanted to. I think that's where Samsung does a really good job, is it's dead simple or it's complicated and, tweakable if you want it to be. And Google never was able to do that kind of dual mode. And so I'm really happy to see them give you something for a camera that's probably, once again, going to be the best available.
Yeah, a couple of weird things here. There's going to be a face retouching feature built into the Pixel now, which I don't know. I mean, that kind of doesn't sound like something Google would do, but maybe they've done it better than the competitors. I don't know. That seems kind of weird to me. What else is there? Save selfie as previewed. What is that? Save pictures with the same orientation.
That's so it mirrors mirror it, mode. So it looks the same.
Yeah.
That's right. Something, again, like been in there since the Galaxy S4 or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So there we've seen the Pixel Themes app for the first time as part of these new leaks. If you're using a phone running Android 10, you can go to the developer options and change accent colors, but it's something that's hidden. This looks like with the Pixel 4, you'll be able to go in to this Pixel Themes app and really kind of substantively change the look and feel of the OS with new fonts, new icon, icon packs, and new iconography, as well as these accent colors.
I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's been something that Samsung has done for a long time and people have really liked, and a core set of people have really wanted to tweak things, but again, doesn't feel like something that Google would do. It feels a little out of their normal wheelhouse.
Well, I think a more direct comparison than Samsung is, like with Samsung's theming, you always kind of, it feels clunky to me because you have to dig through, like there's the store with thousands of themes that you're never going to find the one you want. And like you have to buy some of them. I think OnePlus has always done it really well in their last, 4 or 5 years of phones with Oxygen OS, where it's kind of the same deal. You just choose your accent color. You can change icons. I think that's exactly what should happen on the Pixel. So I'm really looking forward to that because it's like a little thing that you don't have to spend much time on. You don't have to spend any time on it at all, but it can really just like be a subtle thing that makes your phone feel more like it's tailored for you. And I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, Hayato, you had mentioned in our call yesterday that your favorite feature in 2017 and 2018 phones is ostensibly disappearing with all phones from now on, the rear fingerprint sensor being used as a gesture for the notification shade.
Yes.
I just put my SIM card back in the Pixel 3 XL so that I could review Android 10. And that's the best thing about this phone now. So I'm really going to miss it. But one thing that Google is doing is it seems to be adding that gesture to the Pixel launcher. And all of these small additions together make it seem like they're acquiescing to the mainstream, that they're really going after people who have bought Samsung and Huawei phones over the years for all of the additional features because of those tweakability. It's never going to be to the same extent, but I think finally Google is understanding that in order to sell a mainstream phone, they have to add mainstream features.
Just put Oxygen OS on the Pixel.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, it's just like the OnePlus phones. Just cherry pick the most popular features, implement them well. You don't even have to turn them on by default. You could just let the people that want them discover them. And it doesn't have to be an overwhelming, crazy experience. Just do it like Oxygen OS does it.
I mean, it's funny. Like, I can't think of a single thing Oxygen OS does badly.
Nope.
Like, there really isn't. Like, they seem to have done everything even better than Google. Especially, even the gestures are, you know, Joe Maring, one of our editors, he wrote an editorial last week about how the OnePlus gesture system implemented in the open beta is better than Google's own gesture system in Android 10. And it's true. It is. It works better. The 90 hertz display makes it feel more consistent and smoother. I really have no complaints about Oxygen OS. It even got Android 10 the same day as Google released it publicly. It's just in an open beta version.
It is the correct Android software.
Brilliantly put.
It's not in the show notes, but we have seen a couple of leaks about the OnePlus 7T and 7T Pro. I don't really understand what OnePlus is doing now because they have two phone releases a year.
Good, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't the only one.
So now they have to update both of them twice a year. I really don't understand.
And then they're not the same, and they don't, like, they're kind of staggered in their design and their capabilities.
Right. So the OnePlus 7T Pro, which is also a mouthful, the rumored specs are basically identical to the OnePlus 7 Pro, except for a slightly, I think, so there's an upgrade to the Snapdragon 855 Plus, as well as a slightly larger battery, and it'll launch with Android 10. Other than that, the specs look identical. So
this would make a little more sense if we didn't have the really confusing OnePlus 7, OnePlus 7 Pro launch, where they were completely different phones. And the 7 was basically just a 6T refresh, but the 7 Pro was entirely new. Like, it would have made a lot more sense if these had kind of come out together. And I think that OnePlus needs to reevaluate whether it's going to be doing this twice a year, two different phone line release, because this is just like kind of a, not a snoozer, but just confusing.
Yeah, it does seem pretty confusing. I'm looking at the rumored spec sheet for the OnePlus 7T. Same 48 megapixel rear camera. We have a 2x optical telephoto camera, 12 megapixels, and a 16 megapixel ultra wide, which looks to be the same as the OnePlus 7 Pro. So the camera system looks pretty similar. I don't understand it. There's got to be something
else.
It
just creates this weird thing where you have, like, surely the 7 Pro is still going to be on sale for, and then you're going to have the 7T, which has some slight upgrades, but then it's ostensibly the lower phone, and then you have the 7T Pro later. It's just, there's going to be a weird overlap, and it doesn't really fit with OnePlus's typical MO of, you know, you sell the phone for 6 months and then you come up with the new one, you abruptly cut off sales and you just start with the next one. Now you're going to have overlaps of generations between the high and low end, not to mention the fact that you're going to have carrier partnerships involved now that you have the separate 5G versions, et cetera, that are going to be available for longer. So you're going to say, you're going to have this thing where, well, wait, do I want the 7 Pro or do I want the 7T? And, you know, what are the differences?
We'll see. I guess it'll be a, they'll differentiate. Oh, wait, no, the 7T is supposed to have a 90 hertz display as well. Huh. Okay. So maybe a lower resolution screen, slightly less powerful processor. I don't know. We'll see. Let's talk. Are we done with Pixel 4? I mean, there have been so many leaks. It's kind of there's nothing left to learn until we actually get one in hand. We still don't have a date for the announcement. It's rumored to be around the first week of October. Last year it was October 7th. So could be around then, but we, Evan Blass, EvLeaks released a case company render or a screen protector showing an October 15th
screen protector,
date. So it could be the 15th, which would be a week later than last year. Either way, it's coming pretty soon, but not soon enough if these leaks continue at this pace. So all right, let's talk iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, iPhone 11 Pro Max, iPhone 11 Pro Super Max. Hayato, we convened a Discord channel to sass and snark during the announcement, and it was super fun because a lot of people came and just like sat with us and joked around for a couple of hours. But when all was said and done, in my opinion, what was most interesting was not the phones, but some of the services, and in particular, Apple Arcade. And I want to start there because this is something Apple's been teasing for a few months now. And it's basically, we now have a price, it's $5 a month, and it's an all-access subscription to a bunch of games that will be exclusive to iOS, at least for some period of time. And all of the games will be premium games, so no in-app purchases, no ads, and some of them will be brand new when they launch next week. Before we get into the hardware, what's your impression of Apple Arcade as a service, especially given the rumors around Google's Play Pass and how that could be something similar?
I mean, $5 a month for an entire family plan is just a ridiculously good price. I think that was kind of where, even in that chat where we were there specifically, like, to sort of, you know, poke fun and roast the new iPhones and all of that, like, pretty much everybody in the group was universally like, wow, when they announced the pricing for really all of their digital services. I think $5 a month, especially because it covers multiple people, is enough that, like, that's inconsequential for most people. So there's basically no reason for most iPhone owners to not get this service. And you're just going to get a lot of access to games that you probably wouldn't otherwise play. Same as, you know, when Google's version comes out pretty soon, at least as far as we're expecting. I think it's a really aggressive tactic that I'm a big fan of. I think that's really smart.
And aren't they going to be giving a long trial to anybody that buys a new iPad or iPhone? Is that right? Isn't it a year?
That was Apple TV Plus.
Yes.
Oh, it's just TV Plus. Yeah. Okay.
Everybody gets a month of free Apple Arcade.
All right.
When they sign up. So, I mean, that's a long time, but it's probably not as long as you need to play all 100 games. Some of the games.
Do we know how many people are included in that family plan?
No.
I'm not sure. Usually those types of things are up to 5 people.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I mean, even if it wasn't a family plan, like even just for an individual, that $5 a month is fantastic. If you're anyone who is at all inclined to play games on their phone, and I understand that not everybody is, I'm definitely not really in that camp. But if you're at all inclined, you've bought any number of games, then you're probably just going to want to do this. I think my only question, which is similar to the Apple TV Plus subscription, is what does the catalog look like in 12 months or in 24 months to justify you continuing to pay for the subscription? Because when you do pay for a subscription, a lot of people, of course, sign up for it and forget about it, and it's just a small thing and whatever. But a lot of people are going to be looking at it and like, okay, what's the next thing? The whole idea of the subscription is you continue to get new stuff. You don't necessarily just lock into the same 3 games and play them forever. And if you were going to, then you're just probably going to cancel the subscription anyway and just buy those 3 games and be done with it. So it's like, how big are the exclusives? Do the exclusives continue to roll out? And what is, you know, so what does that look like to justify? And you look back and say, well, you know, I spent $60 on this last year. Did I play enough games to justify that?
Especially if you are somebody who would throw down $60 or $100 with on in-app purchases on one game without even batting an eye. This could fill in that hole in your, you know, in your heart without making you feel gross about spending gems on Candy Crush or, you know,
which you should feel gross about.
No judgment. If you want to spend your money on that stuff, go ahead. I just feel like the gaming industry needed a disruption like this, because the only sustained revenue model for game developers has been in-app purchases. And this sort of turns it around and puts the seat of power to some extent back in the hands of indie developers who want to create premium games but would only get that $3 or $4 up front once and then be expected to update their game indefinitely until they come out with a sequel. And that business model has proven to be pretty ineffective at funding gaming houses. So,
well, I mean, ostensibly it puts some of the power back in the developers' hands, but we still don't know what the agreement is like between developers and Apple. I still don't know how the money is distributed. Is it distributed based on gameplay time or, you know, quote unquote downloads of those apps under the service? What does it look like? Do they get more revenue over time as the number of subscribers grows and the length of the subscriptions grow? Or is it something where Apple is just paying the developer out of pocket for X amount of, you know, content updates? You know, those agreements do make a massive difference. And obviously they're going to have big names and big titles on stage when they announce the service, and, you know, later on down the road, hopefully they continue to release those exclusives. But, you know, then, you know, there are the other 98 titles of the 100 plus titles that are available. You know, what do those deals look like when you're not Konami?
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's a great point. There have to be enough financial incentives for app developers to continue to be a part of Apple Arcade. Otherwise, they may just go back to selling games the way that they always did if it worked for them.
I mean, they're doing in-app purchases because it does work. So
it does work.
They could go back to it if they want to and the money doesn't work out.
And if you go into Google Play right now and you go to the top grossing section, it's the same thing. I mean, all of those games are free-to-play, in-app purchase heavy games with pretty big names behind them. I mean, top grossing games, obviously Pokemon Go, obviously Candy Crush. But then there are some others that are kind of weird, like Slotomania slots. I mean, come on, who's playing slot machines?
Judgment. We're back to the Judgment area.
I mean, I'll judge a little bit. That's just not a good way to spend your money, in my opinion. But yeah, a lot of games here, like Star Wars, Galaxy of Heroes, Clash of Clans, Summoner's War. A lot of these are just grindy games where if you don't want to wait for your turn to come back, you just buy in-app currency. And you know, it's kind of gross. And I hope that some of the indie developers who have been overshadowed when Google launches the Play Pass service, whenever it does, will get a chance to shine again, because especially on Android, it's hard to be a successful game developer when you're making premium games.
Yeah, and I don't think that this is going to the just on Apple or on the Google side, it's not going to be the be-all, end-all, and you're not going to get 90% of people to sign up for a game subscription service. But just knowing that the other option is out there could shift the perception of what gaming is like on mobile. And that's what's important. And especially if Google comes out and also hits really hard with $5 a month for a family plan.
I don't really want to talk about Apple TV Plus unless you guys do.
Not really.
Nope.
Okay. Yeah. The less we say about the trailers shown at the conference, the better. So let's talk about the new iPhones. So three new iPhones, none of them surprising, right? They leaked just as much as the Pixels have leaked. I think what is kind of interesting is the iPhone 11 being $699. It's cheaper than the iPhone XR, and it's better. It's still running newer silicon. It's still it makes the same number of sacrifices as the XR, but doesn't kind of change the rules at all. But at $699, that is it's not expensive over 2 years. I mean, relatively speaking, and it's also it's going to be the default iPhone now. They're not positioning it as kind of this side project from the main iPhones. It's the iPhone 11. So,
and I think that was the smartest thing they could have done, was to actually really clarify the lineup, in that there's the base one and it's cheaper, and then there's the nicer one, and then there's the nicer, bigger one. And, you know, making those steps up, much like the Galaxy S10 lineup did, was, you know, I think they understood that the iPhone XR was incredibly, incredibly popular, and it kind of turned into the default one. So now making it clear that you can start at the iPhone 11, you know, base model, and know that that's $700. That's a really good psychological point to be at, rather than making it start at $1,000 and then saying, well, you can get the restricted, you know, different one for less.
And looking at the sales numbers for the iPhone XR, not only was it the most popular iPhone, but it was the most popular phone, period. Like, it sold better than mid-range Samsung phones in the last quarter. So if you look at those numbers, like, obviously cumulatively Android phones sell in far greater numbers than iPhones, right? We know this because there are just so many models. But if you're looking at it on a per device basis, the iPhone is still the most successful phone in the world. And yet Samsung, with its better, better variety of devices through, you know, the entry level, mid range and flagship, you know, they've been doing a really good job trying to claw back, and those A series phones are just incredible. But it seems like everywhere I looked in the last 6 or 9 months, the iPhone XR was the phone, right? Everybody has the iPhone XR. And I guess it just shows that a cheaper iPhone is kind of what people want. So $699, what's the Android equivalent to that? It's the Galaxy S10e, maybe, sort of.
OnePlus 7 Pro.
The OnePlus 7 Pro. But not much else in that $700 range is really competing for attention.
Now, the Galaxy S10 was on sale there for a good while, you know, down near that. But yeah, the S10e... you know, it's the compact, cheaper version, whereas with Apple, they realized that the XR was really successful because it was large and had great battery life along with its low price. So that's a bit more like the 7 Pro. And you know what? Like, people aren't... the average person buying the iPhone XR, or now the 11, because it's the kind of default inexpensive choice, have no idea what OnePlus even is, let alone is actually comparing the two.
I don't know. I mean, I think OnePlus has maneuvered into the larger consciousness. I mean, you're probably right, but I want to give
them... I think it's more in the consciousness of the people that are making the decision to buy an 11 Pro or Pro Max.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because those are the more, like, the more tech advanced, like, kind of nerdy people. I don't think that the OnePlus 7 Pro lands in the mindset of the people that are looking to just get the latest iPhone for the least amount of money.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I think even like when I'm carrying a OnePlus phone out and just like one of my friends sees it and asks what phone I'm on, a lot of the time, like, unless they're, you know, maybe people on T-Mobile that have been into a store recently will see the phones at the store and they'll know what it is, but I think most people definitely still don't know OnePlus as a company.
So we were just completely off topic for a second. We were talking about the OnePlus 7 Pro, so I picked one up. It was on my desk. It was completely dead. This was about 10 minutes ago. I plugged it into the warp charge, and it's already at 39%. I love fast charging. It just makes me so happy.
That's something to bring up on the iPhones, because the iPhone 11 still ships with a 5-watt wall charger in the box, which is just something that is absolutely bananas that this is still the case. But it's one of those things where this is the less expensive iPhone, and those are the, like, people just aren't really going to care. They mostly are going to be upgrading from another iPhone. They already have other chargers. They have their lightning cables. And, like, this is just the cheapest possible thing to include in the box. But I am really happy to see that the Pro models went to 18-watt wired charging. And that's, like, that's good. That's solid. That's at Galaxy S10 level. That's at, you know, kind of your standard fast charging level. And they really needed that because their battery sizes went up too.
Yeah, I agree with that, except for... I mean, there's a couple of things there, right? 80 watts is fine, but it's still not great. Like, it's still not super fast.
Right, it's no 30 or 40 or whatever.
No, and also, this, if they're going Pro, put USB-C in there. This was the year to do it.
I know.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. I mean, the iPad Pro put USB-C in there. This is, I find it so, it's just so stubborn of Apple to continue this. I mean, you they're going to do it eventually, right? Why not just off the Band-Aid?
I was listening to John Gruber's podcast, The Talk Show, which is actually a really great podcast, even if you're not into Apple stuff necessarily. And he says that his take is, as long as the iPhone has a port, it's going to be Lightning. And I'm actually inclined to agree with him, just from the massive install base of Lightning cables that are out there. This isn't just going to be a move like 30 pin to Lightning that really made sense from a packaging perspective, and USB-C just wasn't quite there yet. I really do agree that they're just going to stick with Lightning as long as the phones have a port. And maybe they separated on the Pro versus non-Pro model, I guess. But just the number of accessories and cables out there with Lightning, you know, and it is a smaller package and it is a proprietary one, which Apple loves. There are a lot of advantages to sticking with Lightning, whereas there just weren't any to staying with 30 pin as long as they did.
I guess so. I just think the bulk of Apple's, I mean, basically every Apple product uses USB-C now, except for the iPhone, right? So if you talk about proprietary, here is Apple acknowledging that an open and an industry accepted standard is better for the vast majority of their product lines, including Pro marketing product, products marketed as for pros. And I got roasted on this on Twitter, because I'm like, this doesn't seem like a Pro phone if it's only coming with 64 gigs
of
storage standard. And people are like, well, it's just a name. And I'm like, okay, fine. But this is Apple. They talk about this stuff all year. They're going to base their entire marketing campaign around these phones being for pro users. The pro lineup of their products has always been catered for a different audience. Even if it's just regular people ending up buying things like the iPad Pro or the MacBook Pro, right? It doesn't matter, because it's how it's positioned. And along with those things, you know, Rene Ritchie likes to say that Apple doesn't ship specs, they ship features. So what are they doing with this Pro iPhone that is any different from the iPhone XS or the XS Max, other than adding that third camera?
No, I don't think there's anything that they did add that required it to be a Pro. I guess if you look at it from that perspective, I understand the adding features, not specs. They also talked a lot about specs. They typically try to flex pretty hard on their, you know, the new chip and all of their trillions of operations per second and all this kind of crap that means nothing to anybody. Nobody cares about those speeds and feeds anyway, so I don't understand why they get on with that. But none of those things necessitated it being called a Pro either. I think it just made sense from the, if you look at the way that they've done the iPad lineup, they're kind of just applying the same thing to the iPhones now. Like, you get the base one that's just kind of just the iPhone, and then you have to justify why the iPhone 11 Pro Max is, what is it, $500 more than the iPhone 11?
Yeah, $1099 of $400. So it's $500, yeah. You're right. Wait.
Oh, 700 to 11.
$1099.
$400. Math. Yeah. Like, that is a lot more to charge, and I guess if you can try to justify that by throwing the Pro moniker on there, that's cool. But look, what about a OnePlus 7 Pro is a Pro? What about the Huawei Mate 30 Pro is going to be Pro? Android manufacturers have been throwing out this Pro moniker, meaning absolutely nothing. It means nothing more than a plus sign at the end of it. You know, they could call the Note 10 Plus the Note 10 Pro, and it wouldn't mean anything different, even if that is the most professional capable phone. It's just, it means a little bit more with Apple because they have this legacy of using the word Pro. But other than that, is across the industry, it means just as little as anywhere else.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, I'm the one sort of acknowledging that Apple's marketing has worked, rather than actually saying there is a difference between their Pro and non-Pro products, because there is none really when it comes down to it. So let's actually talk about the camera, because I think that's been the biggest update. Third lens, obviously, ultra wide on both the all three iPhone models now, but they're doing it a little, not differently really, but like the implementation is a little bit more. Sorry, that was my dog shaking.
Zadie,
go away.
Hi, Zadie.
Zadie loves being near me with when we're recording the podcast, but occasionally she gets up and thanks guys. All right, so let's talk about the camera, because, you know, they do things a little bit differently. They take a little bit longer, but the implementation of the multiple cameras feels kind of smooth. Hayato, like when you saw the hands-on videos, it seems like they're doing it right.
Yeah, I love what they're doing with the cameras. I think it's great that they're shipping a wide angle on everything now, because I really don't think a telephoto lens is like necessarily the way to go if you're going to have two lenses. And on the 11 with only two lenses, they're still doing telephoto. It's just digital instead, right?
Yeah. It's exactly.
Yeah. So I like that approach a lot, because I think a wide angle is much, much more important. And obviously you can't just replicate a wide angle with your standard primary lens. I mean, I wrote an article about this. I think the most impressive thing that they showed off, with the cameras was pertaining to video, and the fact that, like, while you're shooting a video with the iPhone 11 or the 11 Pro, the lenses that you're not using are still being primed in the background. And so what that basically translates to is that while you're zooming in and out of your lenses, they should pretty much seamlessly switch. You're not going to notice a big jump in color or in dynamics. You know, your exposure is not going to be all wonky switching between lenses, which is almost always the case with Android phones. You know, that's from their demos and from some of the hands-on videos I've seen, it looks like that works exactly as advertised. And I want that specific feature on every Android phone, every iPhone, just every phone with a camera for, you know, the rest of time. That's something that needs to be everywhere.
And it was my understanding that they're using the same 12 megapixel sensor for all three, correct? And I think that that's part of the reason why they can do that, on top of the processor just being like insanely powerful and being able to handle those three streams. But I think having the same sensor, obviously you get similar or the same camera quality with photos, but it also lets you transition without it in video without being a, you know, having differences in exposure and color and everything when you hop between.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the main, one of the main things they showed off was just the transition, between like when you're digitally zooming in and then it hits a point where you are, you get to the focal length of the next sensor, the transition should be completely seamless. And
it's totally noticeable on every Android phone you've done that on.
Yeah, it is. It's. I mean, some are better than others. Like OnePlus does it really well, actually. Samsung does it really well. LG, not so much.
I mean, even with the Note 10, because I was messing around with it like right after the presentation from Apple. Like the Note 10, it's pretty good about, like, you know, you don't notice like a big jump in color or anything, but especially if you're shooting maybe, you know, you're in a fairly dark room and there's a bright window in the shot, switching between lenses, there's always that jump where just real briefly, it'll adjust the exposure to try and make them match, but it's, you know, it happens in front of you rather than in the background. So there's that difference for like a split, you know, maybe 5-10 frames.
Okay. So video, I think, is also something that's pretty interesting. I'm not even going to mention the slow motion selfie because
don't say it.
I won't say the word slow.
Good man.
Sorry. Nope. I can't help it. It's just coming. It's coming, guys. It's slow fee.
It was a slow roll there.
Oh man, I couldn't stop myself. Yeah, that's a bad look. But other than that, right? Like video capture, Hayato, you can record 4K 60 with all three cameras, which is pretty great.
And even with the front camera, 4K 30, actually, sorry.
4K 30, yeah. Extended dynamic range, basically. What's interesting, too, is that they didn't make a big deal about it, but there's audio zoom now, which is similar to what Samsung launched with the Galaxy Note 10. So when you zoom in on a subject, it will redirect the microphones to just pick up what's happening in the frame and then try to cancel out what's out the frame. I don't know. It didn't work great on the Note 10. It's definitely like you can tell that it's focusing in on the subject, but it's still kind of hollow and doesn't sound great. I don't think it'll be great on the iPhone either.
No, not particularly. But I mean, it's one of those things you might as well include it, I guess. I mean, with the Note, it's pretty transparently just bringing up the gain. But it's, you know, I'll take it. I'm not going to complain that it's there. I would assume you can probably disable it anyway.
Oh yeah, definitely. What else is interesting to you guys? Because you know, we don't know a lot about the A13 other than it's 20% faster CPU, GPU, blah blah blah. We don't have anything to go on, and really, like there's just so much headroom with these A series chips that it makes no difference to most people.
Really doesn't. And Apple really doesn't stress them with anything other than a lot of the camera stuff we were just talking about in regular, you know, day-to-day use and in performance of the software. It's like, man, their chips are two generations ahead what's required to do whatever you're doing. So that's no big deal. But I think the big thing for me outside of the cameras was them focusing on battery life. They actually made the batteries notably larger, and in doing so, they actually made the phones thicker and heavier, which is exactly what every person that complains about battery life on Android says is, why don't you just make the phones a little thicker and a little heavier and just add more battery in? And Apple did that. And obviously, their capacities are still much lower than the Android competition. I think the iPhone 11 Pro is under 3,200 milliamp hour, but they're still talking about, you know, hours more usage. Of course, you know, that's how Apple measures things, not in actual capacities, but in vague numbers about usage. But we know it's just going to be better because it has higher, more efficient chip and higher capacity. And like, that's actually kind of a nice move because, excuse me, they didn't have to say anything about it. They were just like, the battery is bigger. Or the battery life is longer, and you know, however we did it, we did it, and nobody's going to care that it's a little bit thicker and a little bit heavier.
Yeah, what's really interesting here is the so we've complained about the OnePlus 7 Pro being too heavy at 206 grams. The iPhone XS Max was 208 grams, and the iPhone 11 Pro Max is 226 grams.
That's a chonker. Like that is pretty
that's
heavy.
That's really, really heavy.
The Max iPhones have always been like a little too large. But people put up with them for the battery life. And so that'll be interesting to see if you've now tipped the scales a little too far. Because that's heavier than the 7 Pro. That's heavier than the Note 10 Plus.
It's basically iPad mini is what it is.
And the iPhone 11 is like 188 grams, I think. So it's a little more than the Galaxy S10 Plus. That's getting up there a little bit too, considering that that's only a 5.8 inch phone.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's stainless steel, so it kind of makes sense, but still, that is a chonker.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of it, right? We'll have to wait and see if there's any big surprises. There's I don't know, this year feels like it was really, really iterative, more so than other years. The screen is better. It's got a 2 million to 1 contrast ratio because it's an improved OLED display.
Oh, I have to say, everybody freaked out about the brightness. It is not actually a 1200 nit screen. It's an 800 nit screen.
Right. 1200 nits is like maximum when viewing HDR content. And my guess is that it goes right back down to 500-600 when HDR is not on the screen.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's impressive, I guess, but...
I mean, 800 is still great. It's just that there's a big difference between peak brightness on parts of the screen and what normalized brightness across the entire screen is. And I think we're a little lax with using these nit numbers. I mean, Samsung does the same thing. They talk about peak brightness and you look at the Display Mate numbers and it has whatever crazy peak brightness. But the number that you really care about is what the full screen can display.
The funny part is I want to talk about night mode, because night mode is new to the iPhone 11 series, but it's not a manual mode. It's kind of like Samsung's version of the night mode before everybody complained about it. It turns on at a certain lux level, although we don't know exactly what that is. And apparently it detects whether you're holding it with your hand or whether your phone's on a tripod. But I guess this is something that Apple wants, right? This is they want to make a night mode that people don't have to think about. But should it have a manual switch? It feels like it might.
I think it might
benefit from that.
You should do both. Have it come on automatically, or if someone, you know, is smarter than that algorithm, which, you know, we have eyes and brains that can figure it out better, like we should be able to flip it on too.
Especially because, like, as Andrew, you and I have talked about in the past with the Pixel 3, night sight on the Pixel is even useful in the daytime. It kind of rolls out, you know, like it rolls off the highlights and just kind of makes it a more balanced photo a lot of the time. So I would imagine the iPhone's going to have a similar effect. So if you were able to use it in daylight, so I would love to have that manual option.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it comes down to, is just having the choice. Apple doesn't really want people to have that choice, or hasn't traditionally allowed people to have that choice.
They're doing a lot of the same things as Google, it seems like. They're saying the right things about how they use night mode, and that they don't want to just turn night shots into daytime looking shots. They just want to make them really good night shots. Mm-hmm. And I do appreciate that that's their approach.
Other things, Face ID is now 30% faster. We won't know more than that until we actually get the phones or the reviews come out next week. The one cool thing, though, is something that had been rumored to launch alongside some like tile-like tags. But this is it's called the U1 chip. It's an ultra-wideband chip that basically lets you point your phone at somebody else's U1-powered chip, and it'll let you connect AirDrop with them directly. It's interesting because it allows for indoor spatial mapping in a way that GPS doesn't. And it has a lot of other uses, but Apple's only doing it for this one thing right now. What do you guys think about that?
I want to see them announce features that actually take advantage of it. I mean, we just saw a lot of this kind of promise when they talked big game about Bluetooth beacons, and then that all kind of just disappeared as well.
That's true. That is true. That didn't last very long.
Beacons were going to change the way that we get around inside of buildings and the way that we shop and the way that we know where things are around us. And that really just like got canned, basically.
Right.
I still just wish Android had something similar as far as direct peer-to-peer sharing. Because I think, you know, like Android Beam works pretty well, or worked pretty well. But as far as I remember, Google's not really putting much into Android Beam anymore. And even with current phones that do have it, it's basically just, it's still really slow. You know, it's nowhere near the level of, I guess, refinement as AirDrop on Apple devices.
AirDrop is really good.
It is. it's like, it's a lifesaver anytime we're all together and like using our MacBooks for, you know, trade shows and whatever else we need to send each other files. Like, that's the one thing that always makes me glad that we all use an Apple laptop for the most part. It's not really going to get me to switch to an iPhone, but it's a really nice feature to have if you do have an iPhone and your other friends have Apple products or you have other Apple products. There's just not really anything super similar that's natively built into Android.
Yeah, we had this situation where we were in Berlin and we shot some video on my Note 10 and I needed to give it to Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, and it didn't even occur to us that we would try to do some kind of a wireless something or another. He pulled out a USB-C flash drive and I had to plug it in, use the My Files app and go select files and manually move them onto the flash drive and then plug it into his phone and upload them.
It's so clunky.
And it's like, it's so bananas that you wouldn't even think about that on the iPhone. It's like, just use AirDrop and it'll transfer it and it'll work. And this was even Samsung phone to Samsung phone. It's just not even in the consciousness. I'm sure Samsung has some kind of, you know, tap it and move the things. I'm sure it would probably work. It's just the fact that it's not the default choice just shows how clunky this, the wireless transfer system is.
Well, it's not easy. I mean, you have to do it securely. You have to do it in a way, you know, that's fast. You can't do, you can do the handshake over Bluetooth, but the actual transfer can't be over Bluetooth.
No.
So, you know, that's the thing is that there's, you know, it uses a Wi-Fi direct protocol between Apple devices, but that handshake works because there are so many security measures in place that are kept within the ecosystem. And it's not, Google could do that, but it's much harder to do when it's a software-based solution. So, yeah, I don't see it happening, and I think it's sort of a niche thing anyway, especially with the cloud. But it does help.
Very true.
It does help when it's there for sure.
I don't know if it is that niche though.
This is what pros want. All right.
No, I don't mean it's niche in the sense that like not a lot of people use it because millions of people use AirDrop. I think it is it's one of those solutions that people have found, or it's one of those things that people have found other maybe less elegant solutions to.
Sure.
But I don't see it being a need today. AirDrop made sense when it was built years ago, and its use continues to be important because it's part of the Apple ecosystem. But if somebody else, like a Google, tried to build a native AirDrop equivalent, I don't think it would be that useful. I mean, Samsung and Huawei hasn't been able to do it.
But that was only between different Huawei devices, right? Like a MateBook Pro and a P30 Pro or something like that.
Exactly. And how many people have a Huawei laptop and a Huawei phone outside of China?
Right.
Not that many.
Not a lot.
So that I think that kind of sums it up. We don't really have to talk about how the Apple Watch got a very, very minor upgrade to add just an always-on display. Because, Okay. Sounds good. What else? Did we miss anything? I think we did.
That cheap iPad just is going to, the revision of the quote unquote iPad, no number, no generation, just cements the fact that, man, Android tablets are just bad as a whole, as a market. There are a couple good Android tablets, but they just get completely roasted by a $320 iPad, let alone the iPad Pros and everything that they can do for more money.
Real? Is it only $329?
It is.
Yeah.
Man, that is a good price for an iPad.
I think it was Dan Seifert from The Verge that said that now the iPad's smart keyboard cover is like 40% of the price of an iPad because of that drop.
It is. It's like $150. Yeah. Because the new one has the smart connector, and that's cool. But still, you're out the door with less than $500, which is still cheaper than what these high-end, good Android tablets offer. It's just like, why would you even bother? It's unfortunate that that's the case, but man, that cheap iPad, they know it's the one.
Jerry reviewed or is reviewing the Tab S6, so we'll see what he thinks about that. But I mean, just like, that's really the only high-end Android laptop that anybody should really talk about. And that's still, what, $600, $700?
$650 without the keyboard. So I think you're at like $775 or something with the keyboard.
Yeah. Even with the old ass specs on the iPad, the new one, it's still probably a better desktop replacement than a Samsung Tab S6, just saying.
Especially like Apple's improvements, Apple's improvements to iPad OS, as they call it now, are just kind of obviating the need for this kind of dual strategy that Samsung does, where they have Android and then they have the DeX environment on the tablet. And it's, you know, it just would make a whole lot more sense to just make the tablet interface more desktop-y.
Yeah, I have a really good idea. Why don't you release a big tablet screen with no guts in it so that you can place your phone inside it to power a tablet? And then you set up a keyboard and a mouse.
Did you used to work at Asus?
Oh, man. That sounded such a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
What was that called again?
The PadPhone.
PadPhone. Oh, my God.
I wanted one so hard when it was new.
There was also a phone pad, I think, at some point, but I can't remember which one went in which direction.
I kind of miss the old Asus when they just like threw things at the wall and to see what stuck. Like,
they literally had a phone that slotted into a tablet that slotted into a laptop.
Yeah. Oh, man. The good old days.
Yeah. They were old days.
Well, it was the good old bad old days, right? Like when nothing worked properly, but it was way more fun to experiment with.
And Android phones were insane.
Yeah. Now we have the ROG Phone 2, which is just insane in a whole different way.
It's got a light show on the back, right?
Yes, sir. So we will have a review on that phone if you're interested on AC in the next couple of weeks. I think Harish is getting one, so that should be fun. And what are you guys working on that people can look forward to next week?
Oh my goodness, getting my head out from under just a million IFA things. I'm really excited to see more of these Fossil Group watches that just got announced, all based on the Gen 5 platform. I'm also excited to check out the Galaxy Watch Active 2 for an extended period of time. Wearable watch.
And the Fold should be coming out soon.
Yeah.
I guess it'll be a thing eventually.
We'll see. Yeah,
27th.
Again.
2 weeks from today, if Samsung holds to their timeline, at least.
Yeah.
We will see. Hayato, what about you?
Well, I'm heading back to New York for what feels like the 50th time this year.
Let's be honest, it's only the 17th time this year.
Yeah, don't exaggerate. Of course. I don't know. Can I talk about what we're doing at that point? Or
yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's not something. It's not too secret. The iPhone is going to be a thing next week.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, I'm just heading back to New York to help with some collaborative videos on the iPhone 11 and do some comparisons against some other phones. And I guess maybe pick one up for myself and see how that compares to some of the Android phones that I prefer to use in my daily life. But, you know, sometimes you gotta hop over that fence and check out what's on the other side of the closed garden.
Yeah. Yeah. That metaphor,
a little messy. Metaphor.
No, it's okay. I mean, they made it that way. It's not your fault. Well, I'm looking forward to that because I'm really excited to check out the camera comparisons, right? If Apple finally has a competitive camera this year, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what Samsung does with the Galaxy S11.
Agreed. Right?
Like, man, they've got to do something regardless.
They're so far behind now that it is not even, they're not even in the conversation. So yeah, if Apple can manage to do it this year, then Samsung will really have no choice. I think we're going to leave it there because it's been, you know, this is a marathon. I'm glad we did another marathon because it's been a while since we did it. Andrew.
Felt like nothing.
Yeah, just like nothing. Andrew Hayato, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Big yeet.
And if you want to send us your feedback, what do you guys think of the new iPhones? What do you think of all the Pixel 4 leaks? Send us some feedback to podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. Until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
So long.
See ya.